From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a Muslim congregation claims bias and sues Sterling Heights after the city says no to their proposed mosque.
I think maybe some of the rhetoric that we see and hear nationally is trickling down into some of these local communities.
A veteran Broadway conductor tells us why he cringes every time he hears the Star Spangled Banner at the Rio Olympics.
I'm not against a fresh take or a sideways take at a piece of music, but it's the setting. Context is everything, right?
And a new direction for Detroit's Heidelberg Project.
That this is visual hip-hop. This is a new art genre.
Plus, women paying more for auto insurance in Michigan? Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Why do women in Michigan pay more for car insurance than men and more than women in other states like our neighbor Ohio?
Well, insurance companies do a lot of things that don't make sense to you or I, but they themselves have reasons behind that. And the main reason is statistical analysis.
And then a Muslim congregation claims bias and sues the city of Sterling Heights after the city says no to their proposed mosque. That's later this hour. But first, that old spiritual kumbaya makes us think of people coming together, getting along. And there are court watchers in Michigan who are calling Michigan's Supreme Court the Kumbaya Court. And they include Ron Bretz. He's a retired professor of criminal law and procedure at Cooley Law School in Lansing. As a former professor and public defender, Ron's been either arguing before or keeping tabs on the state Supreme Court for 40 years. So Ron, Kumbaya Court, why is that?
That phrase is a reaction to the court we had in the first part of the century. About 1999 to 2010, we had a court that publicly feuded. And if you've read former Justice Betty Weaver's book on this, she pulls no punches in terms of the animosity between the justices on that court. Three justices left that version of the court. And with them gone and the additions of Justice Bridget McCormick, Justices Viviano and Bernstein, they're where they're supposed to be, in a collegial court. The reason we're using that phrase is because it is such a marked difference from what it was during those turbulent years.
Ron, there's a recent piece in Gangwar that noted through the 2015-2016 term, 81% of the arguments held before the court were decided unanimously, way, way up from the previous two terms when that figure was just a little bit more than 50%.
Yeah, and during the first decade of this century, you saw almost none. I mean, I never counted them, but they would be a handful of cases. And the splits in those cases were very deep, very, very deep. The entire philosophy of the way they approached the law was very different.
And this is talking about the so-called Engler Four era, isn't it?
Yes, and they ran the court. I mean, the four of them agreed most of the time. And if they agreed, that was the decision.
So we've got these statistics that have come out that they show just how much from that period you're talking about, like 2000 to 2010, how much the Supreme Court favored prosecutors in criminal cases and disfavored plaintiff attorneys in civil cases. So ultimately, what do those stats tell us about that time period?
There's two ways to look at it, and I'll start with the charitable way, and that is the way that the Engler Four looked at it. When they joined the court, they were part of a group of people who felt that for many, many years, the Michigan Supreme Court had been going in the wrong direction. And it's fair to say, and I will grant them, that Michigan had a fairly progressive Supreme Court. Now, progressive, I don't mean Democrat and liberal. I just mean open-minded. They believed that justice was the goal and not just cold words on a page. And when the Engler Court came in, they saw lots of things they didn't like about precedent that was out there, and they changed it. And they overruled over 400 years of precedent in their 10 years running that court. And when I say precedent, I mean previous Michigan Supreme Court decisions. Now, I'm not talking about them disagreeing with the Court of Appeals. I'm talking about them disagreeing with themselves as an institution. That is unprecedented in the history of this state. They were a very different court. I was quoted during one election cycle as referring to them as the most radical court we've seen in my lifetime, and I stand by that. The current court, I think, is getting back to a sort of equilibrium.
And in doing so, how well is this iteration of the court serving the people of Michigan?
It's better justice. Now, the other court, and I don't want to paint with too broad a brush here, but unfortunately, I think you have to. You mentioned earlier that in civil cases, they sided with the defense attorneys, and typically these were attorneys representing insurance companies or corporations or hospitals. They sided with them in over 85% of the cases. And in many cases, they reinterpreted existing law to reach a different result than prior precedent would hold. And much of it was done in an effort to uphold our Republican legislature. When Engler took over is when the first time in my lifetime Michigan had a government run completely by Republicans. And so the Republican legislature created a number of laws that they referred to as tort reform. And all tort reform does is make it more difficult for people to sue. And so the Michigan Supreme Court had to kind of bend over backwards to uphold many of those laws, even though they clearly violated existing precedent.
So when you look at today's court and you're talking to people in Michigan who may have a case, how well are they going to be served by this court?
I think they're going to get a fair shake. And I didn't believe that 10 years ago. I just didn't believe it. But the reality is, in this country, one of the things that makes our country great, and I'm a true patriot and a believer in the Constitution, is that we give everybody fundamental fairness. You can be the worst criminal in the world. You are going to be treated fairly. And if we can fairly follow the rules, give you all of your rights under the federal Constitution, and convict you of a crime and send you to prison, we did good. And so I think what citizens can expect, whether they are charged with a crime or whether they're trying to sue someone who has wronged them, that they stand in much better shape of getting a fair shake out of the court. I think one of the reasons is Bridget McCormick. She got to that court, and she is smarter than most of them, if not all of them there. She is charming, and she's not afraid to tell people what she thinks. And I think the rest of the court is kind of looking up to her and going, wow, this lady knows what she's talking about. And I think that has a lot to do with the unanimity. They've got a strong voice there. You know, we talk about the U.S. Supreme Court, and they would talk about how somebody like Clarence Thomas doesn't even talk to the other justices. He just goes his own way. You need somebody who will talk to each other and try to reach some kind of an agreement, because it's much better for the court to speak with one voice.
Well, you would know Ron Brett's longtime observer of the Michigan Supreme Court, either as someone arguing cases before or teaching about them. Ron, thank you so much for your views on Michigan's kumbaya Supreme Court.
No problem. Thanks.
Word came this week that changes are on the way for the Heidelberg Project. This is the 30th anniversary of artist Tyree Guyton's transformation of an East Side Detroit neighborhood. And now he's decided to transform the project to, in his words, Heidelberg 3.0. Tyree Guyton's wife, Janine Whitfield, is executive director of the Heidelberg Project, and she is with us now. So, Janine, tell us what's going to be happening at Heidelberg.
Well, actually, you know, I want to just kind of step back for a second and share with people that, you know, we have been having these conversations now for about a year. You know, Tyree started the Heidelberg Project in 1986, and it stands to reason that at some point there would be a change or there needs to be a shift. And what we're seeing now in the community, neighbors much more involved with the Heidelberg Project, we have seen new people move into the area to be closer to the Heidelberg Project, and it's just appropriate now that we will begin to take a step back and try and galvanize some of the efforts that are happening in the community to give the community more responsibility for the Heidelberg Project. So what you're going to see really is, you know, a decrease of the work that Tyree has created on Heidelberg Street and hopefully an increase of new ideas that are coming directly from the community. It's not going to happen overnight. This is a process. This is a transition. And that's what we want people to understand, and it's time.
And the idea that, in a sense, what's been happening for 30 years, despite a lot of odds, whether it's opposition at City Hall, those 12 suspicious fires, but still here after 30 years. So basically a catalyst for more.
Yeah. You know, and Tyree has demonstrated how he is a champion for his city, how he is a champion for the arts. Others are standing on his shoulders, and, you know, we're happy about that. We like the energy that we see coming into the city. We just want to make sure that the work that we're doing has its proper legacy and that the work can continue and continue to really rebuild that McDougal Hunt community.
Now, I'm trying to tell, so I'm going to, from what you're saying, but I can't, so I'm going to ask you, will the houses that so many people from around the world have come to see still be there, or will they be dismantled?
Well, the houses will still be there, you know, because we are not looking at taking any of the structures down. But the Dottie Waddy House, which is where it all began, you know, that's where Tyree's grandfather gave him a paintbrush. We're hopeful that, you know, throughout the next 2 years and with our fundraising efforts, that we will be able to transform that into the Heidelberg Project Museum, you know, to house all of the history of what Tyree started 30 years ago.
When you think about that, still here after 30 years, of what are you and Tyree most proud?
Oh, my gosh. You know, we're getting letters from all over the world and a lot of young people. And one day we looked up and realized that we're really grandparents now, that we have been at this for so long. You know, 23 years of the 30 are mine. And so we're educating a whole new generation. And these young people, a lot of the letters are coming from young people, and they did not grow up with the same kind of baggage that the Heidelberg Project has had in the early years. I think that what I like to, and someone else said this, I love it, they equate Heidelberg, they said, this is visual hip-hop. This is a new art genre. This is the way to bring people together in communities. So art is really energizing. It's energizing a community. It's bringing a new economic base to the community. Art is becoming a social practice. So all of the bumps and bruises that we dealt with as we were building this are all worth it, because what a legacy.
And when you think of your goals for Heidelberg 3.0?
The goals for the Heidelberg Project 3.0 really have to do with, and guess what, they're not even new. It's the same vision that we've always had, and that is a larger arts community, a kind of a cultural village that is not, you know, driven by only one man, but that is now more inclusive of other people who live in the area that have caught on, those newer people who want to be a part of driving a community or rebuilding a community through arts.
Janine Whitfield is the executive director of the Heidelberg Project. And by the way, they are certainly planning events that will mark the 30th anniversary of the Heidelberg Project. And you can learn all the details by going to their website, heidelberg.org. Janine, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. When you think of prison inmates, what comes to your mind first? Bad people best locked away? Judy Patterson-Wenzel wants to change that perception. After a quarter of a century teaching in a classroom in Milan Prison, a low-security federal correction institution, Judy has retired. These days, she works to dispel the prejudice that prisons create, to help us on the outside come to know her students who were there on the inside. Judy Patterson-Wenzel is an author, educator, and social activist. Welcome.
Thank you.
You taught for 25 years, and it was Milan High School inside Milan Prison. How did that program come to be?
In 1977, the Milan District noticed that the prison was across the street and that many, many people come to prison without high school diplomas. And so they just extended their adult ed program over there in 1977. So it's an old program. It's had its share of state cuts, for sure. At one time, we had 11 part-time teachers and 11 full-time teachers with close to 400 students. And it's down to two or three right now.
And what years were you teaching?
1986 to 2010.
In that period of time, how did you see the prison population change?
Boy, that is a really good question. When I started, my classes were predominantly white people, an occasional black man. That prison had about 6% Native Americans in the mid-80s. That changed over time, usually a lot of Hispanics. But as soon as the 90s hit, I had more and more young black kids. And that, of course, was due to the war on drugs and the mass incarceration that we now know. We didn't have the language for it there, but I could see this huge demographic shift in the 1990s. And so the diversity in my classroom was stunning, absolutely stunning. I could have people from Asia, South America, Europe, North America, Native people, Mexican people, black people, white people. It was a rainbow, which I hesitated to tell my friends on the street. It was a very rich learning environment.
What were you teaching?
basically, I taught civics, U.S. history, and English, among other things. At the end of my career, I taught some classes in educational and employment opportunities, getting them ready to go out. And that was really fun. Taught them things like money management and interview skills. Practical skills, yeah.
What were the biggest surprises? I mean, you probably went in with a set of a construct of ideas of how it was going to be when you were in that prison classroom. And so what surprised you?
I was surprised almost every day. They were in many ways just like us, but because they were locked up, they were grieving the losses from home. They were sometimes walking around with chronic illnesses. They had childhood damage they needed to attend to, which was hard. So they were very open to really deep discussions. And it took me a while. I made a lot of mistakes, and it took me a while to figure out exactly how and what to teach them.
What kind of mistakes?
The first one I made was thinking I could teach white history, which was all I knew in the mid-80s. I grew up in northern Michigan. I didn't ever know anything about anybody else's history. So I taught a class in humanities the first year. And it was a group of 15 men, just wonderful. They were at my door. When I got there, they were excited about doing all this stuff. I'd spent a lot of time learning, putting together lessons about Mozart and Emily Dickinson and, you know, the philosophers of Greece. And one man was in the back row and not at all happy with this whole thing. He sort of rattled me about 3 weeks into the class. He said, "Mrs. Wenzel, where's the black stuff? Don't you like it? Don't you value it?" So it was like getting hit in the stomach. And I drove home thinking, what was I thinking?
What a lesson for the teacher to learn.
Absolutely. So I had this continuing mountain to climb until I retired, trying to learn everything I could about other cultures rather than our white culture. It was incredibly interesting for me. They changed my life. They totally changed my life.
So, and it certainly seems that there were, as you say, that they were at your door when you get there. The eagerness was there. And we've heard that from other people who have taught inside prisons, that the students will say, "This is the highlight of my day when I'm here, my week."
Right. Now, some students, especially the younger ones who dropped out of school, had never had a really good school experience, were not challenged very much. They had a hard time. They had a learning curve, too, to figure out what a good student looked like. And sometimes it would take them 2, 3, even 4 semesters to figure out they had to leave the games behind. They had to really work hard and that they were smart. A lot of them did not realize they could do it. That was part of it, too.
I went to your website, judypattersonwenzel.com, and I started reading your blog. And I was struck by the post as you wrote about the most common question that you're asked when people learn, "Oh, you taught in a prison?" And that question is?
Aren't they all bad people?
That seems to be a cause that you really want to press now that you've retired from teaching. Why is that?
Well, I think the prison fence sets up this formidable barrier. If you look at a prison fence, the one in Milan has a double row of fence, and at the top, a double row of razor wire. It's very forbidding. And it not only says the people are bad inside, it says the rest of us need to stay away from them, that we don't want any contact. Therefore, they are invisible, so nobody knows. They're the victim of the single story, that they're bad people. We all make mistakes every day. We all make mistakes. They do too. But to be punished for drug offenses that had sentences, my inmate tutor, my good friend, Mr. Constantine, was with me for 22 years, and he got out early, but his sentence was for 33 years for a drug offense. So that is totally disabling. 90% of all of our inmates in this country eventually go home. And we're not doing a very good job of preparing them to go home.
We certainly know prison reform is a seriously huge hot-button issue in this country and here in our state. And on your blog, you write, you feel that mass incarceration corrupts America's core values of freedom and justice for all people, and that it devastates lives, families, and communities. But then on the other side of the coin, don't you agree the acts committed by these inmates is equally devastating to lives, families, and communities, whether it is pushing drugs or take it up to even more violent crimes?
sometimes, and I think I'm the first one to say that there are people with too much damage and too many mental health issues or whatever that need to be locked away from the rest of us so we're safe. That is totally true. But I'm not sure I wouldn't do the same thing if I were living in downtown Detroit and my mama couldn't pay the rent. If I had the opportunity to make some money off of a drug sale, I'm not sure I wouldn't do that. And also, we need to look at restorative justice. We need to look at figuring out the victims and helping the victims and helping there be connection between the victims and the perpetrators. So there's some healing in the community, so incarceration is not necessary. So there's a whole lot we need to look at. America's very good at punishing and not very good at rehabilitating.
I know you're working on a book, Light from the Cage, 25 Years in a Prison Classroom, about the experiences. What was that like taking yourself through a quarter century of experiences in that classroom in Milan Prison?
Well, I right away knew there were stories there. And so I started taking notes and my assistant took them with me. And a lot of the book is guided by, we called him Mr. C. And I found I probably stayed too long. I was 66 or 67, almost 67 when I retired. I couldn't leave them. I thought, how am I going to live my life without the nurturing that they gave me every day? But writing the book kept them close. That's been a really fun thing to do. Mm-hmm. So I want people to know how wise they were, how generous they were. They were just so eager and so grateful for that second chance.
Judy Patterson Wenzel. Her blog is at judypattersonwenzel.com. Thank you so much for being with us on Stateside, Judy.
Thank you.
There sure have been plenty of Americans winning gold at the Rio Olympics. And each gold medal win by a Yank means that you'll hear the Star Spangled Banner during the medal ceremony. So some are noticing there's just something off about the anthem, but what is it? One of those who is annoyed and can tell us what it is Jason DeBord. He's on the faculty of the University of Michigan School of Music, Theater, and Dance in the Department of Musical Theater, and he is a long, long time veteran of Broadway musicals. Jason, we want you to walk us through, if you can, about why the national anthem sounds somehow different. You brought us some samples?
Yeah. And let me clarify that this is my version of them. This is me playing through the songs.
Okay.
So it's a very realistic simulation, let's say.
Okay. So let's hear what we're used to hearing.
Okay. What I'm playing here is what's commonly called the service version, meaning that this is what's used, you know, by the Army, the Navy, in any kind of a ceremonial setting.
Fair enough. Yeah, it's a little different than Karen Newman singing at Joe Louis Arena at the Red Wing game.
Exactly.
But,
well,
but, yeah.
And people take liberties with the anthem. You know, it happens all the time. You know, when we hear people interpret it differently at games, any kind of sporting event, concerts, in the concert setting, people interpret this piece of music all the time.
Mm-hmm. Because we certainly know from Mark Clegg, having been in here, your colleague from U of M, it has been through many permutations in its life.
It certainly has, and he is the expert.
All right, so that's the service version that we all know in some way, shape, or form.
Right.
Now, let's have you walk us through what we're hearing in Rio so you can help us understand why does it sound so different.
Okay. First of all, it's in a higher key. Now listen here. Here we go again. Now we're coming up to the rocket's red glare. Now here comes Gave Proof. melody there. We'll talk about
You're
that.
You're wincing.
Here we go. Did you hear it under free?
Yeah. What is it?
Yeah. Well, what it is a substitution. Normally, we go to, if you listen to the service version, we go to what's called the tonic or the one chord, which is a very sonoric or grounded feeling.
Yes.
Okay. This is a substitution to a minor chord, which is the sixth degree of the scale. Which, without getting into, basically, it introduces an ambiguity. Some people have said sad. I feel like that's an overgeneralization, saying, "Oh, minor, it's sad." It introduces a different feeling. It brings a different feeling out when you listen to it, and it happens over and over. It's not that it happens once; it happens over and over and over and over and over again throughout this specific arrangement.
Yes. Yeah, so, in a sense, because I had noticed it, and then I saw a story. It was actually David Siegel's story in the New York Times, picked up on your Facebook post, because you must have been hearing it enough where it bugged you to say, "Hey, anyone else hate this or not like this?"
it's the third time through for this version in the Olympics, because this showed up in the London version of the Olympics. My wife forced me on the London Olympics. She said, "What is going on?" And she paused it and had me listen. And I said, "Oh, well, they're going to the six minor chord." And I played it for her. And she said, "Does it bother you as much as it does me?" And I said, "Absolutely it does." and so it's been going on for a while. And it appears as though, I'm not sure, this may be the version that they've decided to stick with in the long run. Mm-mm-mm. So I'm not a fan, you know.
Why is it you're not a fan?
Here's the thing. I'm not a purist. I love interpretation of music. I'm an arranger. I love a fresh take. Igor Stravinsky did a beautiful arrangement of the national anthem in, I want to say it was 1944. It's a fantastic reimagining of the harmonization of the anthem. I'm not against a fresh take or a sideways take at a piece of music, but it's the setting. Context is everything, right? And this is supposed to be a moment when we're celebrating athletes, we're celebrating achievement, we're celebrating
power.
Yeah, and it doesn't matter whatever the country is that's won. I'm not saying this needs to be about America being greater than any other country. It's just a moment of triumph. It's a moment of joy. And instead, someone chose to introduce ambiguity.
Take the air out of it a little bit.
And just steal someone's special moment. Let them be proud. Let them be happy. What's wrong with that? And so that's why it bugs me, is because context is everything to me.
And I noticed you kind of flinched and you were like, "I want to talk about that." They actually kind of changed something up.
Yeah, they put something up an octave. I mean, this is really, I'm getting down to little details, but gave proof through the night that our flag was still there. They go, gave proof through the night that our flag was still there.
Oh, okay.
They go up, and instead of setting up the end of the song, they kind of steal the fire from the end of the song by putting on the in the trumpet line and then having it go up the octave. So,
it's funny because we get accustomed to hearing, as you say, the context, or hearing songs done a certain way, constructed a certain way. And I'll share an experience. I was recently at a Catholic Mass. And everything was jazz, everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to admit, during the entire 60-some minutes, everything done with the jazz chord progressions on the piano in this jazz tempo, it just made me want to crawl the wall. It made me feel like I should be at Baker's Keyboard Lounge having a 7-7, not at a Mass. And it so did not work for me.
Yeah.
Is that what the power of music to make us feel one way or the other?
Well, you know, it's funny because in this setting, the music's almost ritualistic, just like it's ritualistic in the setting of a liturgy,
yeah.
Right? So this is a ritual too.
Yeah.
It's an award ceremony. It's a ceremony. So some of us don't want to stick with ceremony. Some of us don't want to stick with tradition, and we want to hear it shaken up all the time. And some of us find comfort in ritual and mm-hmm. tradition. So I think that's what I can say is that this has struck a nerve.
Tell me the reaction.
Oh, my gosh. I've gotten emails from people both irritated and thrilled about the article that the New York Times wrote when they picked up on my Facebook post. And the comment section of the time is extensive, let's say.
Extensive, shall we say. Debating.
Yes.
Everything in this nation today is a debate,
it
one or the
is.
Other.
It
but what would you like to say to the IOC in advance of coming up in South Korea, the 2018 Winter Olympics?
Oh, I'd like to say, revisit every anthem. You know, it seems as though they may have said, well, this is going to be the definitive version for every Olympic game from here on in, because we don't want to – I don't know if it's a financial thing that they don't want to pay to record it, or if it's just too much of a bureaucratic maze. But I would encourage them to maybe consult with the countries individually and offer their input, and so they can get a definitive version that makes people happy, that makes the people in the country of the winners happy with what they're hearing.
Maybe they want to get some tears from winners standing on the podium.
You know, there's worse things in this world.
That's true. Jason DeVore, I'm the faculty of the Department of Musical Theater at the University of Michigan, and not a fan of the arrangement of the Star Spangled Banner that we are hearing at the Olympics. Jason, such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Pleasure was mine. Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Are women worse drivers than men? If you live in Michigan, it seems insurance companies think so. The Zebra is a comparison website for auto insurance. Its new report on the state of auto insurance pricing turns up this fact that most states do not have much of a gender gap in auto insurance rates. But Michigan is not most states. Neil Richardson is a licensed insurance agent and the resident insurance advisor at the Zebra. Good to have you with us, Neil.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Looking at annual insurance premiums by gender by state, tell us, where does Michigan check in?
Well, Michigan, as far as the disparity between, you know, the premiums and gender, is, you know, falls only behind Wyoming as far as men or women paying more or the other. In fact, in Wyoming, men pay more, but in Michigan, it actually looks like, you know, women pay the majority of the premiums there, or a larger portion of it, I should say. So in terms of the disparity there where women pay more, it's definitely Michigan. They're number one.
What's the breakdown, female to male, and what's the percentage difference?
Well, based on our analysis, we've seen about a difference of about 4.03% between male and female drivers in premiums. So, you know, our base profile that we use to run these reports, women are coming in at about an average premium of $2,175 per year. Males coming in at about $2,087 per year. So less than $100 difference in premium over the year, but it is 4% more, which, you know, certainly makes up a decent amount.
That certainly adds up, and it leads to the question, why is that?
Well, as with most things, when it comes to insurance, it's based on statistics. So insurance companies don't do things that – well, insurance companies do a lot of things that don't make sense to you or I, but they themselves have reasons behind that. And the main reason is statistical analysis. You know, in that particular state in Michigan, I'm sure that statistics would back up that women probably on average file more claims than males do. And insurance companies will, in turn, charge more for that. It'd be the same thing where, you know, if there's a lot of inclement weather claims, the cost of your comprehensive coverage, your weather damage coverage, might be more expensive than it would be in a state that doesn't experience so much loss as far as weather events. So it probably just comes down to, you know, male versus female. Women file more claims in the state of Michigan than men do.
As a matter of fact, speaking of overall claims and overall rates, I look at the chart that's in your report, in the State of Auto Insurance Pricing Report for 2016. Here's our neighboring state, Ohio, where a guy, man, pays an average $763 and a woman pays $757. And here we are in Michigan, over $2,000. Are people in Ohio that much better drivers than people in Michigan? Why is there such a big, big difference with the state that's right next to us?
Yeah, you know, unfortunately, the premiums don't always follow the safest drivers. And, you know, just because Ohio residents get to enjoy the lowest auto insurance premiums across the board does not make them the safest drivers. You know, risk is a huge factor when it comes to pricing auto insurance, especially for the insurance companies. But between Ohio and Michigan, there's a big difference in the way that the policies are formatted. Michigan, the main reason there is that Michigan is a no-fault state. And in no-fault states, you have mandatory coverage that drivers are required to carry for themselves. So in Michigan, it doesn't matter who caused the accident. Your insurance company is going to cover your injuries. In Ohio, they determine fault. So if you're hit by someone else, they're at fault. Their insurance covers your injuries. You know, that's really the main difference in why Michigan is so much more expensive than Ohio.
Fair enough. Let's get back to women drivers in Michigan. Here we are paying 4.03% more than men. Do we have any recourse at all besides suck it up and pay more than the guys?
Yeah, you know, as far as gender goes, it's unfortunate there's not a whole lot you can do about it. It would sort of be like the difference between a single person and a married couple. You know, married couples generally pay less on their auto insurance than single people do, but you're not just going to go get married for the sake of lowering your rate. But, you know, there are other things that you can do other than that don't have anything to do with your gender. You know, credit is a huge factor when it comes to your auto insurance rates. But the biggest thing that has a huge impact on savings would be maintaining continuous coverage. As you hit 6 months of being continuously insured, and then on up from there, 1 year, 3 years, and 5 years, those are the increments that we generally see a big amount of discount when you go to shop for a new policy. So our recommendation, and really the basis of why, you know, the Zebra exists, is to allow people to shop with as many companies as possible. Everybody is going to pay a little bit different. So what company is best for you or is going to give you the lowest rate may not give your neighbor the best rate. So that's why it's really important to shop with as many companies as you can, because you may not be getting as much credit with one company as you would with another based on a myriad of things. I mean, your credit score, whether you own your home or you rent, the length of time that you've been insured. There's all sorts of things that you can do to lower your rate, and then also maintaining clear driving records. I think that goes without saying, but even a minor speeding ticket can really make a huge dent in in your auto insurance premiums. You get these nice low rates, and then you get popped for a speeding ticket, and your rate just skyrockets. So that's really important to maintain safe driving record.
So as my mom used to say, mind your P's and Q's on the road, and also shop around.
Absolutely, yeah. Shopping's the biggest resource that consumers have to, you know, let insurance companies know that they're not happy with what they're paying. If you're leaving and going somewhere else, clearly they're not doing something right, and a lot of that has to do with price, especially for residents of Michigan.
Neil Richardson is the resident insurance advisor at The Zebra. Neil, thanks for speaking with us today.
Oh, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
They asked for permission to build a mosque in the city of Sterling Heights. After weeks of debating, the answer came back from the city, and the answer was no. Now the leaders of the proposed American Islamic Community Center are suing the city of Sterling Heights. They accuse the city of bias against Muslims, and they're seeking damages. We have Azam Elder with us. He's lead attorney in the suit, and Khalil Abbas is here, the member of the congregation. Azam, exactly what was the proposal? I know the community is now in Madison Heights, and the hope was a new mosque in Sterling Heights.
Well, the members of the congregation, about 80% of them live in Sterling Heights. They've had a mosque in Madison Heights, a very small mosque, and their families have grown now to over 300 families. And they've been looking, with the help of the city of Sterling Heights, for about 3 years now for a suitable site. And the site that they finally purchased, which is on 50 Mile Road, was done with the assistance and guidance of the Sterling Heights staff. So that's sort of a little history behind what happened over the last few years.
So Sterling Heights was a logical choice because so many members already live there and families had grown. So how did the community react when the planning request was submitted?
Well, the Muslim community in Sterling Heights, pretty much followed the law, you know, to the letter. And, you know, they felt that it wasn't going to be any problem. They didn't sense any issue at all. I mean, they've been living in that community since the 1960s. It's a really nice community. Most of them, I would say 90% of them, are, college educated, very respectable people, have wonderful kids, veterans of war, educators, UAW employees, physicians, and so on. So this came as a shock to them. I think maybe some of the rhetoric that we see and hear nationally is trickling down into some of these local communities, and that's why we stepped in. We took on their case because we felt that every group deserves the same rights under our Constitution, and that's why we're in court now.
Khalil Abbas, take us back to when the request for the planning permission to build a mosque was submitted. Again, as we heard from Azam, 3 years of searching with the guidance of the city, landing on this site on 15 Mile Road between Ryan and Mount. What happened then?
This was the 24th site that we proposed, and they finally said it was okay. So that's when we started. We purchased the land, and we went through the motions with the city, and everything was good all the way up. Even at the first meeting, looked pretty good. And then they said they want to have another meeting or another vote. And then when that other vote, and there was the protests outside, and it was unbelievable. I just couldn't believe it.
Tell us about the protest.
Well, from what I seen and what I heard, the signs I seen, they were like, go back ISIS, or no to Muslims, or it was all kind of stuff. They were trying to get to me. They pulled the, my niece's scarf. She was in front of me. It was just unbelievable. It was more hatred than it was the protest of building the mosque where we want to build it.
And this was residents who came to the Planning Commission meeting to voice their protest.
These were the ones that were outside. These were the protesters that were standing outside when we were walking through and going back to our cars after the vote. And to me, it was more the hatred than it was to oppose the site where we wanted to build. Because they said it wouldn't fit there or it looks out of place. But there's plenty of churches that are and temples and sheikh temples and stuff that are right in the side of a subdivision.
As a matter of fact, I know we've received a statement from the city of Sterling Heights and saying in part, and here's a quote, Sterling Heights has a solid reputation for inclusiveness and tolerance. And that statement points to, among other houses of worship, just as you said, Khalil, two existing mosques, a Sikh temple, a Buddhist temple. I'll start with you, Khalil. Why do you think the city said no?
I think it was because there were going to be a vote, and the mayor was up for re-election, and he seen that the protests that were in front of that site long before the vote. He seen what was going on. That he seen that people didn't want it, and I think he went against it. And the mayor, he's had a lot of influence on city council and on the planning commission, and I don't think he supported it. And I think that's what happened. I think they got scared. They didn't do the right thing.
Give me your thoughts, Azam Elder.
I'd like to respond to that. So the city, look, things are not all bad, right? I mean, so the city of Sterling Heights is a wonderful city, and they have wonderful residents. Now, for the mayor to respond and take credit for the fact that they have Sikh temples and a couple of mosques, I don't think, again, I think he's being more political. He took an oath in office when he's sworn in as mayor. He basically takes an oath to uphold the Michigan Constitution and the U.S. Constitution, and not to put politics before those sacred documents. And in this case, those mosques were built not under his leadership. What's being tested now is the current leadership of Sterling Heights. And what's changed? If they've allowed other mosques, other churches, other temples to be built, why was this mosque denied? And the only question, everything we've discovered in our investigation points to the fact that it was discriminatory in nature.
Azam, you learned about some emails that were exchanged among residents and city officials. Tell us about those.
Yeah, there was some troubling emails that we discovered during our investigation, and all that's been turned over to the Justice Department. They were counting votes, which they're not supposed to. I mean, people who sit on the council or on a planning commission, there's something to protect the public, which is called the Open Meetings Act. So they're not supposed to make any decisions in private. They have to basically do it openly and publicly, unless there's an exception. Well, we discovered that they were sort of counting votes behind the scenes, which is not appropriate. That's the first thing. The second thing is that, there were some nasty emails put forward by some residents. And one of the candidates who was running for office, who was trying to use this as a launching pad, and that candidate lost the election. But they asked the chief of police, have you, checked with the FBI to make sure that, that these people are not on the radar? And again, it kind of takes you back to McCarthyism, right? I mean, it's everybody feels that if they lived, during the time of civil rights or during the time of, before women had their rights, that they would be on the right side of history. Well, what people don't realize is this is just history, recycling through, and now it's just you're dealing with another group called Muslims. And in this case, the chief of police, who's now retired, he's the chief of police. You've been dealing with this community for 50 years. An email shouldn't trigger a response, oh, yeah, we're going to go check these guys out with the FBI.
So there was a response. There was a response from the chief of police. So he engaged.
There was a response, and he sent it to his deputy chief, who is now the current chief of police. So we don't know what they did, but the point is that, for God's sake, you're the chief of police. If you have probable cause against any individual, you're vested with the power to protect the community, right? But to go on innuendo, on emails, you know, kind of like the way the era of McCarthyism worked, you know, where you accuse people of being communists. I mean, you know, you would think that people in those offices know history and also use the power that's vested in them to do the right thing. And I was telling, you know, look, a lot of the members of the Muslim community, there's been a lot of anxiety with their kids over the last year. And, you know, they live in the community. They're not used to this type of controversy, this type of attention. And it's been a lot of stress. There's been a lot of stress on them. But, again, people have to ask themselves, are they on the right side of history? And right now, the mayor, the council, and the leadership of Sterling Heights, they should do what the previous mayor did, which was he allowed two mosques to be built because they fit within the law. And the Muslim community is not asking for anything special. They're just asking to be treated like every other citizen.
Azam, tell us about the suit, and particularly what constitutional amendments that you're citing and what you're seeking.
Well, there's obviously the freedom to worship the way you know, any citizen is allowed to worship, and then you have zoning laws. But there's a federal law that deals with the Religious Land Use Act, and that specifically is very, very black and white regarding what cities can do, because across the country, it's not just Muslim communities, but it's many other communities where, because religious institutions are tax exempt, you have a lot of local cities who play games with religious institutions, and they'll come up with what they consider lame excuses. You know, the traffic is not addressed, or the aesthetics of the neighborhood's going to change. So Congress passed a law which pretty much says that you cannot put a higher burden onto religious organizations. So in other words, if the city wanted to build a library or a school, or they were going to allow a restaurant to build in an area, the burden cannot be heavier on the religious institution. And in this case, Sterling Heights does not allow religious institutions to build within their zoning districts, except they must apply for a special land use exception. And they don't put that burden on themselves. So why are they putting that burden on people who would like to build, you know, a house of worship where they can take their families and practice their, you know, their right to practice their religion? So that, and from our perspective, after our due diligence, we feel that it's pretty clear that the city of Sterling Heights is not following the law, and we feel that the leadership basically put politics above their oath of protecting the Constitution, and that's why we're in court.
In our last minute, Khalil, just tell me, what would you like to say to the people in Sterling Heights who put up the sign saying, we don't want it, and build it elsewhere?
I'd just like to say, to get to know us, that we're very good people. We're just like you. We're Americans. We're immigrants, just like everybody else. We're loyal to this country. We love this country. I mean, I couldn't ask for a better life than I have in this country. Why would I want anything else? Why would I want it to change? I just want a place to go, take my family, meet with other families, and to worship God. Sterling Heights is a wonderful community. It's very diverse. I mean, there's everything there you need. It's a very safe community. It's very nice. I wouldn't want to go anywhere else. But I just, if people got to know us and knew who we were, I think they would change their mind in a minute.
Khalil Abbas, a member of the group, the American Islamic Community Center, hoping to build a mosque in Sterling Heights, and Azam Elder, who's lead attorney in the lawsuit being filed against the city of Sterling Heights after it denied permission to build that mosque. Thanks, gentlemen, to both of you for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And you can read the full statement on the lawsuit from the city of Sterling Heights on the Stateside page at michiganradio.org. Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia, engineered by Rusty Brack. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors include Allie Billings, Mike Blank, and Lindsay Scullin. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.